Welcome to the Great Coaches Podcast.
To me, being perfect is not about that scoreboard out there.
This is a chance of a lifetime.
When you can understand the person, you can then work towards a common goal.
We are all on the same team.
Know your role and do it to the best of your ability.
Focus on the fundamentals. We've gone over time and time again.
Your defense has got to be better.
Leave no doubt tonight.
Great moments are born from great opportunity.
Hello and welcome to the Great Coaches Podcast, where we believe that there is no algorithm for leadership, and so we interview great sports coaches from around the world to try and find ideas to help all of us be better leaders. Our great coach on this episode is Vestin Hafsteinsson. Vestin is an Icelandic former Olympic discus thrower who is now considered to be the most successful discus coach in the history of the sport. He represented his native country at 4 Summer Olympic Games and 5 World Championships. As a coach, he has worked with world and Olympic champion Gerd Kanter and Olympic silver medalist Joachim B. Olsen, and is currently coaching Daniel Stahl and Simon Peterson, the gold and silver medalists at the Tokyo Olympics. In all, his athletes have won 19 international championship medals, including 5 medals from the Olympic Games. Vestin sounds a lot like Arnold Schwarzenegger, and as a result, I was on my toes for this terrific interview with a coach who has a deep functional specialisation. Some of the key highlights for me were his view that athletes are owned by society and so must be good role models. How he lays out the path to an Olympic medal requiring 70 training camps, 200 meets, and 4,000 training sessions. The role that speed and rhythm play in his training, and how he describes how this must come together in the 1 second when someone throws a discus. And the importance of happiness and calmness, and how he helps his athletes find this so that they can perform at their best. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as we did. And just before we go to the interview, if you like what we do here at the Great Coaches Podcast, then please head over to our website where you will find loads of exclusive audio and video content. Much of it has not been released on the podcast, and you can download it, share it, and get a conversation going with your own teams around the things they may need to do to lift the leadership within the group. And now, please enjoy our interview with Vestin Hafsteinsson.
You're listening to the Great Coaches Podcast.
So, Vestin Hafsteinsson, I hope I got that correct. Good afternoon and welcome to the Great Coaches Podcast.
Thank you very much.
First Icelandic person we have had on the podcast. So, very much looking forward to hearing a different perspective perhaps on coaching and leadership. But, Vestin, could I start with something? Probably just a little simple question, really. Where are you in the world and what have you been doing so far today?
I live in Växjö in Sweden, and that's in the south of Sweden. And I was coaching this morning, had 3 sessions with 3 athletes. And so that's what I've been doing. And then I ate lunch and now it's 3 o'clock and I have another session in a couple of hours.
Well, thank you for speaking to us on your break before you start up again. Vestin, in researching you, I can see that you've been to countless Olympics and World and European Championships. In fact, one article I read said you've been to 55 international championship events as either an athlete or a coach. So I imagine you've seen some good coaches and perhaps some not so good ones up close. But I'm wondering what this experience has taught you about what the great coaches do differently that sets them apart.
Well, to begin with, I respect all coaches. And they all do their best, probably. But of course, like you say, there are world-class coaches that are called like serial winning coaches, maybe, that get very good results during a very long time. And what kind of differs in those coaches is that they during championships, when you see them, they are very calm and they have put up a strategy before the championships, and they coach much less than the less experienced coaches. So I would say everything is more simple, and they keep their feet on the ground and have a pre-planned strategy that makes them get their goals during championships. That is pretty much like what I can say about that. You have a plan, you have a structure, you do it, and you believe in it, and you're calm, and you coach less.
When I read interviews with you or I read some of your blogs, you talk a lot about happiness and calmness. What have you learned about the role that these two emotions can play when you're preparing for something like the Olympics or a world championship?
I believe in what I call the happy campo. People that have a happy life usually perform better if you're just a happy person. And I've done a lot of lectures about that. So I always look at the social issue and the mental issue of the athletes and try to have that in balance. Everybody can technically and physically be in shape when it comes to going to a championship. But it's always a social and mental role that plays the biggest part. To feel good and have a good life, that brings you kind of to being calm. It's very important to be calm as a coach, and it's also very important for the athlete to be calm, and that's very hard to do if you're not happy. The cooperation between the coach and the athlete has to be built on trust and calmness, and that means that both parts are in balance and feel happy together in what they do off the field and on the field.
Christian, when I was preparing for today, I watched video of your athletes perform. I watched discus throwers and some shot putters as well. And what really struck me was the athletes seem to have this balance between high intensity in a small space. They're very, very focused at the same time. But they also look almost like dancers. They have this great rhythm and flexibility, but of course they're not smiling. And I'm wondering if we just focus on the discus for a minute, could you describe what the perfect performance would look like?
Yeah, I thought it was kind of funny that you said that they almost look like a dancer without a smile. I really like that because that is pretty much the way I think it. I think those 300 to 400-pound guys, they're between 130 and 160 kilos. They are supposed to be like dancers in the circle, because if you think about a discus throw, it's all about rhythm and speed, and you have one second to do it. The discus from the swing until you release it travels around your body 9 meters when you're turning this 1.5 turn that you do, and that is like 30 feet. You're supposed to throw it with a 38.5 degrees angle, and it goes as fast as 20 meters per second at the release speed, that is approximately 95 kilometers an hour. Their maximum leverage, separation, and speed is done in a smooth, relaxed way, more or less without a thought, just automatic, as a machine almost, or a robot. Is that maybe the perfect performance? Yeah, when it comes to a discus throw, that is pretty much like a perfect performance, because that's the question. Could you describe the perfect performance for us? But in maybe not in numbers, it's more about like all sports, physical speed and smoothness or rhythm with technique and mental inspiration or intensity bond together in a period of 1 second. That is pretty much how discus throwing is.
When you were reflecting on the success of three of your athletes in Tokyo, Daniel, Fanny, and Simon, you made an observation that I thought was very interesting. You said all each of them had to do was have a normal day in order to win. Now, the prospect of having a normal day and achieving something special like an Olympic medal is not something you might expect to hear. So I was wondering if you could tell us why a focus on just having a normal day was so important.
It kind of reflects to what we were talking about earlier about the social and mental issues. When you go to the Olympic Games or World Championships, European Championships, Commonwealth Games, Pan American Games, wherever you're competing, it's the biggest competition you can participate in. And the Olympics are the biggest. And I learned before the 2008 Olympics, I had a guy that worked very closely with me and Gert Kanter that won the Olympic gold in 2008 Olympics in Beijing. And my cooperative guy, Raul Repane from Estonia, he came to me the night before the competition and said, we're going to go out and eat and celebrate. We're going to celebrate the win before, the day before. But why? Then he had came up with an idea that was Gert Kanter. He is prime time age in relation to history and statistics, and he only needs to throw his top 10 average to win tomorrow. His biggest competitors was one guy from Lithuania, Virgilius Alekna. He was 1 year too old. And then there were two others from Poland, Malachowski and Robert Harting from Germany, that 1 year and 2 year too young, and their top 10 average was not good enough. And I asked Raul, what's Gert's top 10 average? Because I was not into that at that time. 68-80 meters he needs to throw to win tomorrow, for sure. And I believed him in him, and then Gert won, and he threw 68-82. And then when we were at the doping test after the meet in a basement somewhere, I asked Gert, how was this throw, 68-82? And he said, average. That's a big or like a pretty good explanation on what I go for. And because discus throwing is an aerodynamic event, history says that usually in big championships, discus throwers do not throw PBs. It's much easier to run 100 meters, 110 hurdles, long jump, or even long distance running because you're competing against others at the same time. But when you're throwing, it's a very technical event, like I explained before. It's 95 kilometers an hour. The discus travels around you 9 meters. It's very easy to miss a little thing that hurts you very much, as well as you throw further if there is good windy conditions. And when I went to the Tokyo Olympics with Simon Pettersson, Fanny Rose, and Daniel Stoll, I had a goal that they would throw their top 10 average. And I built it on history, and I built it on statistics within the throwing events. They all performed between 99.47 and 99.83% of their top 10 average, and they all reached their goals and became home with a gold and a silver in the discus throw with that philosophy. And why aren't they performing up to 100%? Because nothing really within those events says that you're going to do it. Then I would be very underdeveloped coach if I would go there and dream of doing something more than history and statistics of all throwers in the world says how it's going to be. That's the reason this works, and I've always thought it like that. And it's because it's hard to go to a championships, and it's mostly hard mentally to keep the pressure when you have to turn around yourself in 1 second with a plate in your hand and hit that perfect throw. It's very, very hard to do. And history says, if you throw your top 10 average, and if you are that good that your top 10 average can be a winning throw, that's the only thing you need to do. And that's what I call to focus on a normal day.
In the lead up to the Olympics, I've heard you say that you tried to coach your athletes as little as possible. Why is that?
Like I told you in the earlier answer about the top coaches in the world, I'm considered one of those in the discus throw for men. And 12 weeks before we go to the Olympics or World Championships, it's already decided what we are going to think about. The brain, the human brain, can only think about one thing when you turn around in a discus circle in 1 second. You cannot have two things in your mind. We have science that kind of supports that with studies. And 12 weeks before, because of adaptation variation principle of training, it takes some weeks to adapt to do something, then we decide what to think about 12 weeks before, then we keep that plan, and when we come into the Olympics or World Championships, we just follow that plan. And then my work in meets or championships is the easiest work in the world, because I just hold the athletes in the hand in relation to motivation, inspiration, support, etc. But I keep myself to this one thing of thinking that we have been doing for the last 12 weeks, because we need to adapt to it, and then we need to do it during the games under pressure. That's hard to do, and the more simple it is, and the more calm I am, and that I don't kind of drift away and start to talk about some other stuff, then I can pretty much guarantee that the athletes are going to perform, because they have one maybe technical issue in their head. They have 1 second to do it. They have 1 minute to prepare. And they go in there only with thinking about this one thing. And I keep myself to coach them on this one thing. And because of that, I coach very little and almost nothing. And so in that way, my job is done in training during the whole year. And then when it comes to competing, we are just testing if it works. And the more simple it is, the better we do.
So 1 minute to prepare, 1 second in the circle. And yet I've heard you talk about it, the fact that it takes 8 years to be a world champion. And this breaks down to 70 training camps, 200 meets, and 4,000 training sessions. Now, the dedication to achieve this must be tremendous. And I'm wondering, how do you help your athletes balance the commitment needed to achieve this without leading them to burnout?
It's a cooperation. And when an athlete comes to me and out of those 57 athletes from 10 countries that are coached, I've only recruited one. All the others, through contacts or through telephone or email or wherever, they have contacted me and asked them to be their coach. I do a little background study on them before I say yes. And then I say, if I say yes, I say yes. And I tell them, are you willing to be with me for 8 to 10 years? Are you willing to do the 10,000 hours? Are you willing to do the 100,000 throws that is needed to reach the top? And if they are, then we go. We go together and we believe in the system. And I'm the boss. I'm a nice guy, but I'm very, very clear on what I want, and I know what they need to do. And if they don't buy into that, then I tell them, okay, that's fine. Just remember to invite me to your wedding anyway. And that means we're going to be friends no matter what. If we work for a year, it doesn't work. I feel the athlete's not doing what is needed, or the athlete feels that this is too tough. No hard feelings. But I listen to them, and they don't burn out because they know what they're going into. They buy into it. They pretty much buy into the system, and I feel them out. I feel what kind of personalities are these people. And I learn to work with them, and they learn to work with me. And those that buy into it, they go to the top. So we have a very little issues of burnouts or not being committed or inspired or motivated to continue. But there's one rule. I cannot go harder on the athletes. The athletes has to go with me during those 8 to 10 years. I cannot go harder. They cannot go harder. We have to do this together and bond. And if we do, it's a really, really winning system.
Bestin, you competed against, you actually beat the famous Olympian Al Orta twice, the American discus thrower. Did he influence your coaching in any way?
Not really, but I had a very special relationship with him. Al Orta won 4 Olympic Games, and with Carl Lewis, I think those two are the ones that have won 4 Olympic medals in the same event. Carl Lewis in the long jump and Al Orta in the discus. So he is one of the biggest discus throwers that ever lived. I was very happy that I got to be able to compete against him twice when he made his comeback, and happens to be that I beat him. But that's not the big issue. The big issue is he, among others, Mac Wilkins from America, John Powell from America, Wolfgang Schmidt from America, Jürgen Schult from East Germany, Wolfgang from East Germany also, sorry. Those guys, along with American throwers like Al Orta, affected me very much. So I'm a product of, if we take the positive stuff about East Germany, the system, how the system was, and if we keep the drugs away, it was a very organized system. And I read 2 books about the system, and I really got to love the system, and then got to know Wolfgang Schmidt and Jürgen Schult, and then work with Mark Wilkins and John Powell. So I'm a product of a combination of very good systems. It's like East German organized system along with the USA free spirit system. Because I always went to America, I went to school in America, and I love America, and we've been going to San Diego on training camps with my top athletes for 15 years. And then I'm a Nordic country guy. I'm from Iceland and I live in Sweden. So this combination of this systematic stuff from Eastern Germany, free spirit of USA, and then with some kind of common sense way of thinking from the Nordic country, I think it's a good combination. And I've been extremely inspired from those people. And the biggest thing with Al Orta and me was that after his career, he started to paint, and I actually contacted him and asked him if he could paint 2 abstract discus pictures for me, and they are hanging on my wall here. And so I have had a very good and very special relationship with Al Orta, and I'm very proud of it, that I have two of his paintings hanging on my wall here after his day.
Well, we'll have to show me them after we've finished the interview. I'd love to see them. Bestyan, you mentioned it earlier. You've coached athletes from all over the world. I mean, I could find Iceland, Estonia, Denmark, Sweden, the United States, Great Britain, and I'm sure there's many, many others. What has this taught you about the style and type of communication you need to use with elite athletes?
It has actually taught me a lot. 10 countries, like you mentioned, Iceland, Sweden, Denmark, Norway, Estonia, Egypt, Canada, USA, Great Britain, Bosnia. Men, women, different culture, different language, different religion, different race, has broadened my way of view very much. I believe in multicultural society, and I've really been able to get to know a lot of different way of being. It's all about respect, no matter what, support of each other. We are a team together, we are individuals, and we get better as we are in a group. We solve all problems directly. We put everything up on the table. I feel the athletes out. If I feel there's a problem, we fix it right away. And if you get to be beaten, you accept to be beaten by your training partner. If you have to settle for a silver, then it's okay that your training partner from whatever country it is can beat you. That's how we can work with those people together. And I'm very proud that I've been able to work with all those athletes from all those countries. That has given me extremely much in my life.
Bestyan, drugs is an issue in athletics. It's a topic that will probably always be discussed. And I know that in the distant past, you had your own issues with this, and I don't really want to go over that. But I'd rather ask you now, how do you deal with ethical challenges when they come up?
I'm very much straightforward, and I believe in, like I told you earlier there in the last question about putting everything on the table. There are challenges in a group like this because we are coming from different societies and stuff. I'm very, very clear on my view in relation to rules and regulations. I think I'm very fair. I don't allow drugs. I don't allow alcohol. I don't allow smoking. I'm not interested. We have had some issues with different things. I always do a very much checkup on my athletes before I get them to count to check out their history in relation to this. We have had some issues. We have fixed all the issues with communication, respect and support, and I just want a class act behavior. I want to be a class act, and I want the athletes to be class act. We are owned by the society. We are known people. They are superstars. They are role models. They have a huge responsibility to act as role models and act as a class act. Within the group, there can come up different problems and ethical and behavioral problems. And I'm just very, very honest when it comes to this, that I respect everybody. Everybody respects me. We are a team. If there is a problem, we fix it right away. And we have to think about that we are responsible as athletes to be a good role model and show a class act.
I've heard you talk about the idea of prehab instead of rehab. Sounds like an idea that all of us could apply to our lives.
How does it work?
It works like, I think a lot of athletes use it as a excuse that they are hurt. But why are they hurt? Very often, injuries mostly happens because of bad planning or of the coach. The planning is wrong. The intensity is too high or the volume is too much. So it's a bad planning that makes an injury, or very often maybe a bad decision that I could even say a stupidity of the athlete, that they don't following the training program that is already written out. So you hurt yourself, and in relation to avoiding this, I'm very much, very little for rehab. I much rather talk about prehab. Avoid to get injured. Very often injuries happens because of what I told before, bad planning and stupidity. It's very seldom it happens because of some unluck, but it can. So rehab is about following a training plan, 100%, making a training plan that is in relation to the athlete done in the right way, where the coach is putting a lot of effort into hitting it right when it comes to volume and intensity regulation, and the athletes follow it, and the coach makes sure that the athletes follow it 100%, not 99%, 100%. And that means that you have to, in that training program, you have to take care of booking massage, booking chiropractor, doctors to look to get a health control, etc. Talk to your psychologist and or a mental coach. You cannot skip that, because this is a part of the training program, and that means that prehab is about taking care of the body with the people that work with you, the massage therapist, the psychologist, the chiropractor, the doctor, the physiotherapist, the nutritionist. Take care of business. And if you follow that and you use me as a coach and the expert team around you to take care of your body, and you have your own responsibility as an athlete to follow that and do that, then you don't hurt yourself. And the best example of that is Gert Kanter, that I had for 12 years. He actually never hurt himself. Was he the biggest talent that I have ever had? No. Was he the biggest physical or mental prospect? No. He never got hurt. He never got a break. He could follow the program 100%, and then he won. And it took him 10 years.
Beshten, just one final question, if I could. And before I ask it, I'd like to phrase it with a quote, and it comes from you. And you say, "We are getting money for throwing a plate. People get crazy about that, and it seems kind of stupid. But it is a symbol of making people feel good. Sports results are the easiest way to make a group of people, a whole nation, feel good for a short period of time. And that's what we accomplished." It's a great quote. And it made me wonder, actually, when I was reading it, what is the legacy that you would actually like to leave as a coach?
Yeah, I usually finish up my lectures around the world with this question. What's the meaning of all this? And my philosophy is this one. We are actually making a whole nation or a whole city or a whole village or whatever the group is happy. And that is actually very important. But if you isolate discus throwing, that maybe 30-year-old, 400-pound guy is throwing a plate out in the air, and you isolate it from everything, then that is kind of idiotic thing to do. It's pretty much like you would look at my face, or I would look at your face, and you would only look at the nose, and there is no connection to anything else. Then the nose is kind of ugly. But if you look at the nose in cooperation with the face, then we look okay. And that is the same thing. And then I started sometimes to wonder, how can I be working with this full time? And I compared to my child friends in Iceland, in Selfoss, Iceland, two of my best friends, one is a medical doctor and the other one employs 250 people. And I'm just a discus coach. What's the meaning of all this? And then I actually felt pretty good that the meaning of it was this one, that we made a difference. We made a difference to millions of people around the world. When Gert Kanter won the Olympic gold, the Estonian nation was following it with like probably 60 to 70% of the nation was following it on live TV, and made this young nation that has been hurt for very, very years, feel very, very good about the symbolic discus throw that made them feel very good and proud for Estonia. And I really got to know this last year also, when we came home with a gold and a silver from the Olympic Games. I've never, ever experienced anything like it. And not only in Sweden, also in Iceland, when we went this summer to Iceland, to my hometown, and it was a kind of homecoming for me. And the president came there, and ministers and politicians and a lot of people to mostly celebrate me. It was just amazing how much a discus throw can make people happy. And my legacy is, I wanted to make a difference, and I've felt I made a difference mostly in Iceland, Estonia, Denmark, and Sweden, where I've been very successful. So, but it's not about prizes, it's not about titles or the medals. It's about when you get the phone call from a former athlete 10 years after they're done, and they say thank you. That is pretty much the name of the game for me.
Beshten, it's been fantastic spending an hour with you. I have loved every minute of it. It's such a unique insight into excellence at an individual level and the relationship between that individual and the coach. So thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the great coach, Beshten Hufvudstensen. I hope you got a lot out of Beshten's deep functional expertise and the way he was able to connect that to elite performance. When I listened back, some of the other key highlights for me were how coaching athletes from all over the world has taught him about the importance of dealing with problems directly, but also respecting the competitive benefits of your teammates. How he steps back from coaching his athletes 12 weeks prior to an event so that they can be focused on what they have already established. The story he tells about celebrating an Olympic victory before the event, and why Olympic medals are won by having a normal day in throwing events. And how the great coaches are calm, they have a strategy, and they keep their feet on the ground. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. And just before you go, if you have any feedback, then please let us know. The interaction with the people around the world who listen gives us great energy and keeps us going. And so if you have any comments, please let us know. And if they're positive ones, then please spread the word with your family and friends too. All the details on how to connect with us are in the show notes or on our website, thegreatcoachespodcast.com.